take a look at the list of folks that were signed up before, or maybe you could just indicate who you were, unless you've got that right in front of you.
Right. I think it might be easier if I read names.
Please, go ahead.
These are the people who came last week and signed up but have not spoken yet. And Matt Ferris-Smith. Okay, good. Come on up. Good. That's great. Stay here. Ian McKenzie. I know is here.
Another one.
Price is Right.
All right. And Marshall Johnson. Carol McCarty. Mel Hofsos. Mary McMurray, Jeff Cole. Jeff is here. Come on up.
Come on up. So we're going to allow 2 minutes per person, so be succinct, please, because we want to hear from everyone. But we're very happy that you're here, and take it away.
Thank you. My name is Matt Ferris-Smith. I'm here to encourage you to support the Residential Infill Project. Before that, I just want to say thank you. No matter your vote on this issue, I'm proud of our council members for considering this proposal to increase housing options for people, and I'm sure you're tired of hearing about it at this point, but thank you. With that said, I really do think there is just one right way to vote on this issue. We need to re-legalize housing choices that will help Portland remain inclusive, walkable, and vibrant as we grow. And I'll be honest, I'm not from Portland. I realize that might make my testimony a little bit suspect for some people. I moved here in 2007 after college, and now I have a graduate degree and a job that I love. I'm happy here, but I can only afford to live in Inner Northeast because I'm willing to live with housemates in a detached house designed for a family. I'm not asking for pity or anything because I love my housemates and I have a roof over my head, unlike many people in our city. But at 32 years old, it's sort of crazy to be in a situation most people associate with people 10 years younger than me. And the Residential Infill Project, I know, won't solve our affordability issue, but it's a strong step in the right direction. And I think the staff proposal is a good start. I would change just 3 things. First, please allow for flexible setbacks. The proposal calls for increasing setbacks to 10 feet, and that's an arbitrary number. I mean, why not allow for some flexibility, especially if it means preserving trees? Second, I strongly encourage you to expand the housing opportunity overlay zone. I understand the David Dundas School District has crowding issues, but excluding the school district, the entire school district, from middle housing is not the solution to that problem. People in East Portland deserve to have housing choices and walkable neighborhoods, too. The same thing goes for the many other parts of Portland that the overlay zone leaves out. I have a third point, but I'll wrap it up. Thank you so much.
Make it real succinct.
Okay. I would just ask that you make off-street car storage optional for all infill housing. Requiring car storage drives up housing costs by a huge amount.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Welcome.
My name is Ian McKenzie. I first came to Portland in 2004 and spent the summer living with my sister, who already lived here. I worked in a cafe by PSU and fell in love with Portland. I moved here in 2009, unsure if I'd be here for more than 3 months. It's now been 7 years, and I've made a life and career here. As you might notice from my accent, I didn't grow up in the States, and in fact, originally from Scotland. After last week's election, it's tempting to say I'll move back, except after Brexit, I'm not exactly proud of being from Britain either.
Hey, Scotland did the right thing.
We did, as did Oregon. So, you know, I think I'm here for good. I'm a renter, and I'm trying to save for a deposit at the moment, and it's tough. Prices on older homes are going up really rapidly. I see friends of mine who bought houses only a couple years ago and are very aware that they couldn't buy in the neighborhoods they were in if they were looking now. The market isn't building new housing that I or people in similar income brackets can afford either. There are a lot of reasons for this, but one of them is that we have a zoning code that encourages McMansions. As the Residential Infill Project report says, the average size of new houses in Portland is 4,461 square foot, and the zoning code allows for houses up to 6,750 square foot, but only if they house one family. As I mentioned, I grew up in the UK, and although I don't actually know the size of the house that I grew up in, it was a fraction of 4,461 square foot, which is the size of new houses, not existing ones, but more than enough for my parents to raise a family in. Indeed, the average size of all houses in the UK is 85 square metres, or 915 square feet. For new-build houses, the average size is 818 square feet. I mention this because within the maximum size recommended in the report, you could fit three units of the average size of new UK houses. Now, it may sound tiny to American ears, but those are livable houses and are more likely to be suitable for first-time buyers, like I hope to be one day, young families, or downsizing seniors than what is being built today. So I'd strongly urge council to stop regulating how many families can live in a single residentially scaled building and start allowing triplexes and duplexes, or as Commissioner Fritz and I might call them, semi-detached houses. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Hi. Hello. Can I have the computer screen?
Yes. Sue will probably need to help because it takes a village to operate our AV system. So. Okay.
Okay, cool. Hi, my name is Jeff Cole. I live in Sunnyside. And in general, I support the views of the so-called RIPS Act 7. But I want to just talk about Sunnyside in particular, that Sunnyside has many narrow streets. We have an irregular street pattern with long blocks and dead ends. We have one small park shared with an elementary school. And we also have a large, officially park-deficient area. Sunnyside already has a surprising population density of 19 residents per acre compared to the Pearl District at 24 residents. Sunnyside also has a significant middle housing supply today, 1,500 units of duplexes, triplexes, quadplexes, apartments, and condominiums on zoned properties zoned today, R2.5 or R5. Sunnyside is about 60% rental housing, and three of my five abutting neighbors live together in shared housing as rentals. So we have to look at how RIPS Act would affect that kind of shared housing. In Vancouver, BC, strata titling or making condos on single-family residences is prohibited. You can share ownership, but you can't share title. Sharing title could break up these lots, make them harder for family generations to share, and that would make it harder for aging in place to occur. Overlay zones in general are more restrictive. They tend to restrict and add requirements and not liberalize requirements. Allowing increased density typically occurs within a base zone that is spelled out as a special plan district. Sunnyside RIPS Act impacts go well beyond school districts. We need to look at street parking capacity, demolitions, historic resources, shared housing, as I mentioned, tree canopy, which helps to mitigate heat sink effects of nearby corridors, impact on urban wildlife, and other goals. I just want to point out, as part of the comprehensive process, we were told that outside of a few lots, this was in our newsletter, and our land use chair, in conjunction with BPS representation, wrote, no comprehensive plan map changes are proposed within Sunnyside single-family neighborhoods. So I think what I would like to see is, my own preferences is the 0.5 FAR on all lots, whether they be 2.5 or R5, a 10% FAR bonus for attached houses in R2.5, and limiting ADUs to one per R2.5, R5 lot, with emphasis on interior ADUs. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I'm sorry, what was your bonus suggestion? Go back to that.
10% FAR for R2.5 on attached houses.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you all very much.
All right. The next on the list, Caitlin Baggett Davis. Pat Hilton, they're here. Jess Larson, and that's it for.
Okay, then let's move to tonight's sign-up sheet, please.
All right, number one, Luke Norman, Daniel Miller, Robert McCullough. Robin Sonoda.
All right. Welcome. Good evening.
Great, thank you. My name is Luke Norman, and I live in the Sullivan's Gulch neighborhood. I want to thank the mayor and the commissioners for taking the time to listen tonight. I'm strongly in support of the residential infill proposal with one tweak that I'll get to in a moment. I first want to say that after tonight's discussion and hearing from many of the members of the community, it might be tempting to take a middle path and to say, these concepts sound good, but let's limit to a pilot, or let's let the neighborhoods decide. And I would strongly discourage you from taking that path. If you, like I, support families being able to walk to parks, neighbors supporting local businesses, and also having driving as an option but not a requirement to get to your daily needs, I would encourage you to not limit the neighborhoods where people can enjoy that livability. Let's allow that to be an option across our city. Our neighborhoods may be different, but I think all people should have options to be able to enjoy those key features. Also, my tweak would be to look at the David Douglas School District. We're adding some great transit there with the Powell Division Bus Rapid Transit. We've also made some great investments in transit there with the light rail, the Green Line heading north-south, and also the Rose Quarter, the Gateway Transit Center. Those are areas where housing options can be very beneficial, allowing people to live in a variety of housing areas and also be able to take transit where they need to get to across the city. As our population ages and many people who previously were able to drive are now unable to, having housing options near transit in the David Douglas School District and across the city will be a benefit. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
My name is Daniel Miller. I am a citizen as well as an artist, and active transportation activist as well. I will say first thing that I live in a shared household in Northeast Portland in a three-level Victorian that has a second full kitchen on the second floor because of an internal conversion of the kind that was allowed during the 1940s housing crisis in Portland, and makes for a great household, actually. But which has not been allowable for over 50 years now. I really believe we should make this decision and similar ones in the future free from fear of speculative dire consequences. We need to build more housing. People are moving here. We cannot evade this reality. Therefore, I fully support the residential infill project as well as the goals of Portland for Everyone. And beyond that, for example, tiny houses, cottage clusters, multiple examples of multiplexes, as well as with good attention to and implementation of preservation of urban tree canopy, ADA compliance, expanded ADA compliance even, which is great for aging in place. I would say that in some of the opposition that I've heard, I sense a profound and deeply ingrained sense of entitlement, sometimes couched in terms of environmental friendliness, to a status quo that only became normative in Portland in the last 50 years. And what we're talking about here is infill. It's simply to say that we currently have a set of rules which is actually more than a permission. It's a de facto directive to build gigantic lot line filling single family trophy boxes. And or we can choose to change this set of permissions and therefore this directive to no, let's actually reduce the size of these new single family homes and build smaller, individually less expensive units, as well as both new and internal conversions, and a return to the very mode of zoning that facilitated the creation of our desirable neighborhoods in the first place. And I guess I will just, looks like I have, I cannot tell.
Oh, yes.
Thank you very much.
That's great. If you have other thoughts, don't hesitate to send them in by email as well. So. No, we appreciate you being here and appreciate your points. By the way, we were going to talk about when we were going to keep the record open for people to send in information, so I want to get back to that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Aloha. My name is Robin Sonoda, and I have recently moved back to Portland after a 20-year absence from Hawaii. I moved into the numbers. I haven't seen a lot of people here from the numbers, but I'm very glad I stayed because a couple of people have talked about the David Douglas School District and laying it open for future development. I don't feel that that's timely at this point. I live in the Centennial neighborhood, just adjacent to David Douglas. I am a licensed teacher. I'm currently in a semi-retirement and substituting in the David Douglas School District. I've worked in both Centennial and David Douglas. Both districts are packed to the gills. They're packed because of people fleeing upscale development, as you know, and coming into the neighborhood. they're starting to be packed and in high demand because they're pretty much the only affordable place to live in the city at this time. Many of my students do need additional housing options. I've been following closely the corridors and centers idea for division, and even that has given me pause for concern because there is no place in the David Douglas School District to put anyone. There are no available classrooms. Classrooms are 27 to 35 students. There is no space currently. Even if state coffers were to begin to funnel money based on the additional tax base to the districts, it would take a long time to plan and develop schools there. So I'm urging you to think about, not only for David Douglas, but Centennial, the ramifications of development that might be too unchecked. And to be cautious, I'm neither for nor against the measure. Listening to everyone's testimony has given me a lot of consideration, but I'm saying in our neighborhoods, I would approach things a little bit more carefully and be cognizant of the learning environment of the students.
Thank you very much for taking the time to come down.
Thank you very much. Thank you all.
Next are David B. King, Constance Beaumont, Fred Leeson.
Hi, good evening. Constance, go ahead, please. Just put your name in the record and proceed.
Great. Okay, can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, my name is Constance Beaumont, and I live in a 1,300-square-foot house in Laurelhurst. I just have two recommendations to make tonight. First, I think we do need to create affordable housing. I, like others in the room, have family members and friends who need affordable housing, and for that reason, I support the idea of the internal conversions, and our neighborhood association voted to support those. That said, the RIPSEC proposal overall seems likely to encourage more demolition of existing homes, especially smaller, more affordable ones. In this folder, I have solicitations that I've received personally from developers to buy my house. I get these every other week, and they all want to buy the house for all cash, no inspection, kind of a neon sign that they want to tear it down. But in any event, the proposal's assumptions seem untested. So as others have recommended, I would urge you to conduct a pilot test before risking permanent damage to older neighborhoods. As one witness said last week, don't repeat the mistake of the 60s when well-intentioned but flawed urban renewal programs wrecked countless city neighborhoods around the country. Second, instead of racing ahead to meet an arbitrary deadline, given the proposal's long-term consequences, take just a few more months to get things right. And one idea is to consider partnering with the Urban Land Institute on an interactive conference in early 2017 that would bring in planners, local officials, and other experts from jurisdictions that have worked out successful solutions to the challenges facing Portland. Invite representatives from Arlington County, where I used to live before I moved here about a decade ago, where the county chose to focus higher density development along transit corridors instead of scattering it around half the city. The policies for Arlington's Clarendon Transit node in particular seem especially worth examining. They yielded a significant increase in density, but still managed to preserve the identity and architectural heritage of older neighborhoods. The Clarendon node also recognized the importance of good design in higher density development.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. Thanks a lot.
Oh, can I just make one more suggestion to invite Mayor Joe Riley, who's the former mayor of Charleston and a wonderful innovator, and he's now with the Urban Land Institute as a senior fellow.
He's a fine fellow, and I can vouch for him.
Okay.
Thank you. Good suggestion. Thanks a lot.
Good evening. I appreciate your dedication. Fred Leeson speaking on behalf of the Bosco Milligan Foundation, the Architectural Heritage Center. We look at this issue from the perspective that we believe that preserving and conserving our great residential neighborhoods is vital to our environmental, social, and cultural goals. With that framework in mind, we look at the RIP proposal. Part of it is terribly frightening to us, and part of it is entirely acceptable. The person who speaks after me, Steve Dodderer, will speak to the positives. I'll be Mr. Negative tonight. And the thing that absolutely scares us is the sweeping scope of the housing opportunity overlay essentially eliminates single-family zoning from the city of Portland, flies in the face of 40 years of comprehensive planning, would be a tremendous incentive for continued demolitions. There is no urgency right now. We know that from from the city's own studies about additional housing units. We know that this proposal, the extent that it's scrape and rebuild, is not going to provide a single affordable housing unit. It's just not going to happen. Look at the 300 or 500 demolitions we've had and how many affordable houses. I think it's probably zero. We think the one-size-fits-all is not a good strategy planning for a city that values neighborhood planning. I think the beauty of today's hearing, as at least if I listen to it, is there are parts of this city where these options are entirely accessible and I think could be very successful. There are certain some neighborhoods where they're just not going to work and they shouldn't work. So I think we've got to take a finer grain look at it. I will let Mr. Dodderer tell you about the wonderful parts. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Next, Steve Dodderer, Jim Hauer, Michelle Anderson.
So you guys flipped a coin and you got to be Mr. Nice Guy?
No, I'm just naturally that.
That's not naturally negative. Thank you very much. Go ahead, Steve.
Okay. I'm Steve Dodderer, again, testifying for the Architectural Heritage Center. The parts of the current document that we're in favor of, I guess, are the ones related. The first three related to the proposed reductions in allowable maximum square footage and the way height is measured. We're also in favor of the proposals which allow additional units within existing buildings. That is I think in addition, the staff recommended looking at some changes to the building code and other codes to make the internal conversion option more feasible, and we would urge you to include those in your recommendations. We also support two additional requirements. One would be a suggestion that the third accessory dwelling unit only be allowed when an existing building is preserved. And the other is, I think it's given the analysis here that says that we have no guarantee that these will provide affordable dwelling units, but you have the authority now from the state to begin to implement affordable housing requirements. I think this is one of the places to try that out with some of these new forms to say, okay, if you're going to have a third unit, yeah, but that unit needs to be affordable in some way. And so that then we're actually guaranteeing both the types of housing that people are asking for and the affordability for that unit, which it's only useful if it's affordable. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Welcome.
Mayor Hales and commissioners, my name is Jim Hoyer. Today I'm speaking as chair of the Portland Coalition for Historic Resources. It's important to remember that before implementing any RIP proposals, Portland already has 40,000 single-family houses that sit on land that can be built out with greater density. That includes 20,000 sites eligible for duplex construction and another 20,000 that are actually on sites zoned for more density. And we'll talk about some specifics in a moment. I'll focus on the R2.5 zone. That's one single-family residence per 2,500 square foot lot. The RIP project proposes expansion of this type of housing, R2.5, into substantial opportunity areas. And is that necessary? As of today, there are 13,000 houses on R2.5 lots. Of those, 8,500 sit on 5,000 square foot lots or larger and are thus eligible for higher density right now. RIP should be asking, how do we accelerate densification of existing R2.5 zones in economically and environmentally sustainable ways? It's a huge question and is not being addressed directly. The total improvement value, that is the buildings themselves, of the 8,500 houses in the R2.5 zone on the 5,000 square foot lots is $1.8 billion. That's a lot of money to throw away in the interest of affordable housing. Mass demolition is hardly economical or sustainable. Our answer is to prioritize incentives for micro-infill, like ADUs and duplex conversion on existing properties in these zones. There are several proposals in REP that lean in that direction. And where demolition makes economic sense on lots larger than 5,000 square feet in the R2.5 zone, promote equity by incentivizing middle housing forms like attached row houses or attached houses and row houses that favor fee simple owner occupancy rather than rental units. For example, in Irvington, only 30% of our plexes are owner occupied, whereas 87% of our single family houses and row houses are owner occupied. We support a focus on RIP recommendation number 7, which promotes densification with preservation of existing structures and target that to the existing R2.5 zone. We urge you to tell BPS to refine recommendation 7 proposals, set numeric goals for numbers of additional housing units in the existing R2.5 areas, and then evaluate that result after 24 to 48 months.
Thank you very much. That's very clear. Thanks. Welcome.
Hi, Michelle Anderson. I live in Overlook. I want to start by thanking you for having a second hearing tonight to allow working Portlanders like myself to speak on behalf of this proposal. I'm a huge fan of middle housing. You can probably guess by my age that I support density. So you can categorize this as testimony that is generally in support of opening opportunities for middle housing. However, I think there is a potential for a couple unintended consequences from this current proposal. To really make middle housing successful, we first need to address two big issues, and that's home ownership and fair housing. My understanding is that this proposal intends to increase the supply of housing by allowing subtle increases in density throughout single-family residential zones while still maintaining the existing character of our neighborhoods. I have also heard that the city is tenancy neutral, and home ownership was not addressed as part of this process. I am here to testify that there must be more intentional discussion about this priority. There are many factors that lead to displacement, and although some homeowners are getting displaced, I think it is safe to say that given the Oregon state limit on property tax increases, most of the people impacted are renters. Why then are we focusing so much of our efforts on rental housing and so little on homeownership? I think we can all agree that the current sale prices of a home is unattainable for most Portlanders. However, with an increase in the income potential from a home comes a commensurate increase in the value of that home. What once was a single-family home for, say, about $300,000 now has multiple units and could cost hundreds of thousands more. I believe that having more homeownership opportunities is an important factor in breaking the cycle of displacement. What this current proposal does is create additional wealth for those that already own property. Condominium development is not happening in this city. There are barriers to building condos, and other ownership structures like co-ops are uncommon. We can't assume that these new middle housing units will be created as ownership opportunities. ACS data show that less than 15% of current middle housing units will be created as ownership opportunities, is owner-occupied. Historically, homeownership has been a vehicle for wealth generation, and I'm worried this proposal will lessen the opportunities for owning a home, definitely in relative numbers and in absolute numbers when considering affordable homeownership opportunities. Additionally, you should consider the implications of the Fair Housing Act, which exempts owner-occupied units with no more than 4 units. This proposal may successfully increase the supply of rental housing, but it will only do so for a certain class of renters. Thank you.
Thank you. Very helpful. Thanks very much. Thank you all. Okay, let's take 3 more.
Okay. James Offsink, Evan Heitman, Stephen Gunvalson.
Good evening. Why don't you go ahead while they're getting settled?
Sure. Hi, I'm James Offsink, and I'm testifying in support of the residential infill project, generally. My partner and I have been homeowners living at 45th and Division for almost a decade now, and over that time, our neighborhood has been one of the epicenters for infill development. I believe that the new neighbors, businesses, and infrastructure accompanying this development have made a neighborhood that I already loved even better. I strongly support the residential infill project and believe a yes vote is necessary for sustainability and social justice reasons. We need to take bold steps now to continue to build on the things that have made Portland such a great place to live. This vote is your chance as a council to encourage affordable housing in an equitable way across the entire city. I recently ran for office, and as I walked from neighborhood to neighborhood, I was very impressed with the decisions that previous generations of Portlanders have made to infill and creatively divide larger, older houses to build up a diversity of housing stock, often without any off-street parking additions. It's no coincidence that many alternative housing types, including garden apartments, duplexes, quadplexes, internal conversions, ADUs, et cetera, are prevalent in some of the city's most popular neighborhoods. Density in neighborhoods attracts local businesses and helps them thrive. It makes it easier to provide services like broadband and public transportation and creates connected, walkable communities. The issues of our era, in my opinion, are climate change and wealth inequality, and it's rare to be able to work on both of them at the same time, but that is exactly the opportunity that you have today. The council should make a strong statement for current and future generations of Portlanders. Encouraging affordable housing benefits young people, communities of color, people living in poverty, and many other groups who are often underrepresented in our decision-making. Our communities are better when they are more diverse, and every neighborhood in Portland needs to be stepping up to the plate and to be infilling sustainably. I'm 34 years old, and I plan to be living here 50 years from now. I know that the decisions we make today will determine the livability of Portland in 2066 and beyond. Are we going to be the city that shuts out newcomers and is unaffordable for even those who grew up here, or will we truly be the city who works for everyone? Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
My name is Evan Heitman. I live in the King neighborhood, and I'm going to relay the Neighborhood Association's decisions, and then I'll speak for myself. So on August 10th, King Neighborhood Association endorsed the Portland for Everyone platform, which I'm sure you're aware of their platform, so I won't reiterate that. We also heard a presentation from a representative from UNR last week, and I brought that to the board, and the board voted to remove our name from the UNR list. My understanding is that our NA endorsed a UNR resolution a couple years ago that was related to demolition, but their position they're currently taking doesn't represent us anymore. So now that's King, and now for me, I just want you to urge, I want to urge you to include an additional bonus unit if it's affordable or accessible. You've heard from other folks that that's really important that we have affordable units, and it's also important to have accessible units. I'm still fairly young, but I do have some mobility issues that aren't affecting me now but will in the future, and I'd love to be able to downsize to a smaller house in my neighborhood 50 years from now when I may not be able to go up as many stairs as I can now. And that's certainly true for my parents. Right now they might have trouble living in my neighborhood because there isn't anything that has a ground-level entrance. So anything you can do to incentivize building accessible or affordable units, I highly encourage you to do that. And I think there's room in the current proposal to allow a fourth unit with either of those requirements.
Great. Thanks. Thank you very much. Welcome.
Good evening. My name is Stephen Gummelson. I am a PPS educator. I've been in the city of Portland for about 2 years from a transplant from Omaha and then from Minneapolis. So first of all, I kind of just want to challenge you that you're competing. You know, these middle-sized cities in this country that I've lived in are all in kind of the same quandary. And I think that, first of all, just statistically speaking, you need to look at what's in, you know, the human capital interests. I've been teaching for 10 years. I have a master's degree. I'm a bilingual educator. I'm a highly demanded in my field. But I'm not able to live where I work. I serve a school that is 100% free and reduced lunch. I have over 50 languages in my school, and I find that this is the best place for that community in the city of Portland. And living in these mid-sized cities, they provide the services. There are successful nonprofits that advocate for these families' needs, and they also advocate for my needs. And I'm just here kind of anecdotally. I don't have any data with me, and I just want to encourage you to vote yes in the residential infill project to make homes affordable for myself as a professional where I want to live in Cully, the neighborhood that needs community members to be involved, to have that effect, to have that long-lasting effect for all people, because right now they're slowly being pushed out. And I really encourage you to think about the lives of the people that are being affected by the lack of affordable housing and by the demolishment of mobile parks in the outside Northeast. So thank you for your time this evening.
Yeah, great. No, thank you very much. Thank you all. Very well done.
Thank you.
Next are Brian Allen, John Sandy, Alyssa Eisenstein-Kruger. They'll be followed by Claire Coleman-Evans, Alyssa Helkaya, and Rod Merritt.
Welcome.
Okay, I'm going to jump in, keep things moving. Hi, Mayor Harrells and Commissioners. My name is John Sandy. I live in Northeast Portland, and I am a member of United Neighborhoods for Reform. My comments are going to focus on the scale and mass sections, what I'm talking about. One of the core issues that drove the formation of the residential infill project was to address neighborhood compatibility or context within new development. While recognizing that neighborhood character is difficult to define, it then falls on scale and mass terminology and limits to achieve the goal of managing new development towards this compatibility goal. And yet, in only one limited phrase, does this proposal refer to existing structures as a guideline for new development. At first glance, the floor area racial discussions and comparisons seem to indicate a significant step to limiting mass. But in reality, the new guidelines would just impact a small number of the most egregious examples recently built. The clarification in setting heights limits based on low points of surrounding grade does have a positive effect, but yet again has no strong link to existing residences. In many neighborhoods with multiple blocks of modest bungalows and Tudors, a 30-foot tall house would be totally out of place by anyone's aesthetic sense. And I'll add, even within my own neighborhood of Beaumont, Wilshire, going from Alameda Ridge going north, one size does not fit all, even within a single neighborhood. Other communities have developed area-unique housing style approach to defining new development envelope or box. I've got an example that I included with my testimony. And my question is, why can't Portland take a similar approach of some differentiation rather than the one size fits all? The relative uniformity of front setbacks of houses may be the key block-to-block congruent flow of a neighborhood. The proposal does push back the existing guidelines from 10 to 15 feet, with a possible waiver being given to allow matching adjacent 10-foot setbacks. Again, I ask, why can't Portland, as other cities do, link this key feature to all existing setback conditions? And again, I've got another example included. So I'll finish up. While there's no simple direct methods of defining neighborhood compatibility, many other municipalities have used wording and graphics that take into account existing houses as guides for new development limits regarding scale and mass. I urge, and I'm not promoting smaller in this one, it's more neighborhood context. So I urge the City Council to direct BPS planners to include similar, reasonable nuances within the recommendations. Portland's admired and valued neighborhoods deserve nothing less. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
My name is Alyssa Eisenstein-Kruger, and I am a Hand resident, a real estate broker who has spent a decade advocating for and working with first-time homebuyers with low to moderate incomes to become homeowners, and I am a steering committee member of the United Neighbors for Reform. The vast majority of new homes that have been built over the last few years, particularly on the east side, already meet the proposed guidelines in the RIPSAC proposal for house size, particularly when you add in the additional 1,200 square feet allowed for basements. That includes a lot of the Everett homes, the Renaissance homes, all of those homes, most of them already meet, or would not change because they already fit into the guidelines that are being proposed. I am hearing others state that this proposal is going to eliminate McMansions, but that is disingenuous and downright false. With the exception of only a few very large homes, we will still see the exact same so-called McMansions being built because they already fit into the new and improved size guidelines, and there is a market to purchase them. For residents who are tired of seeing the out-of-scale and monotonous new housing being built, they feel comforted when they hear RIP supporters stating that the antidote to McMansions is this proposal. But that they feel comfort because that is what they want to hear. I urge council members to study the facts and data before blindly believing that this proposal will end the construction of large out-of-scale housing. As long as a developer sees a profit in large single-family homes, they will continue to be built. Not a single home built by private market developers over the last few years has been more affordable than the housing it has replaced, even when factoring in duplexes replacing single-family homes. The duplexes sell in the $500,000 to $900,000 range. Developers pay $400,000 on average for a lot, usually with an existing home on it. They use the back-of-the-envelope formula of taking the acquisition price, timing that by three, and adding 2 to 10% when deciding whether purchasing a property makes financial sense. With a $400,000 property, a builder is going to be looking at making $1.2 million on return, and in this market, they are getting $1.2 million for these homes that already fit the proposed size guidelines. The proposal offers zero pathways for the increase in density to run parallel with an increase in true affordability using the 80% below MFI metric, let alone 120%.
Thank you very much. Okay. I'm very pleased that you gave us it in writing because I've already sped ahead to look at the rest of it. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Okay, let's take the next three folks, please.
Allison Hilkaya, Rod Merrick, Andrew Burt.
Rob testified earlier.
Mike and Karen Andrews.
I'm sorry? Go ahead. Why don't we let her go ahead, and then since I interrupted your process. Oh, yeah, come on up, please, if she called you. Please go ahead. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Allison Hilkaya. I was born in Portland. I've lived in the Lentz neighborhood for the last 8 years. I'm here to speak in favor of the residential infill project and the extended benefits of the Portland for Everyone proposal. We need city zoning policy to incentivize smaller and more numerous units over fewer and larger ones. We need city zoning policy to encourage free market answers to the need for affordable and accessible housing. Currently, market forces are working against Portland families as limited supply and outside speculators drive up costs. Let's reverse that trend. Our city needs supply at the low end of the housing market. Small units are more affordable and more environmentally responsible, especially considering that the majority of Portland households have only one or two people living in them. At the same time, we're seeing too many demolitions and too much loss of our urban tree canopy. Allowing a second home on the same lot if the existing home is preserved, and allowing flexibility in the setback requirements for tree preservation are two specific proposals that preserve the character of existing neighborhoods while accommodating population growth. I strongly support smaller structure footprints for two reasons, both of which are of great importance in my neighborhood. I mentioned I live in Lentz. Excuse me. The first is affordability. My neighborhood has many existing two-bedroom homes of less than 1,000 square feet. These have been affordable for first-time homebuyers, families like mine raising children on a single income, older people looking to downsize and live on a fixed income, and many more. However, the new construction in my neighborhood since I've lived there has focused exclusively on homes over 2,000 square feet, and these are out of reach for so many Portlanders. In some neighborhoods, the problems associated with housing may have to do with preserving property values or aesthetics, but in my neighborhood, it's a matter of financial stability and geographic displacement. My neighbors are afraid. We don't want to be uprooted. We don't want to have to move our children to new schools. We already live on the outer east side of Portland and have a time tax because of the longer commutes. We've already borne more than our share of increased density, and public investment in infrastructure has not kept up. So my final comment is, when the 1980 comprehensive plan was adopted, it was not implemented in all sections of the city. So I urge the council to muster the political will with whatever zoning changes are adopted to see that they are equitably applied citywide. Effective zoning regulations will direct private investment to better suit the common good. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Hello. My name is Mike Andrews, and I've practiced landscape architecture for over 20 years. I'd like to share my concerns regarding RIPSAC concept report. I understand RIPSAC was initially created to address livability concerns expressed by Portland homeowners. Residents' concerns were focused on aggressive infill that was out of context with the surrounding neighborhood and the impacts associated with the loss of neighborhood character. To my knowledge, the genesis of RIPSAC was not born from the concern of affordable housing or methods of increasing housing density in existing neighborhoods. I would like to redirect the conversation to its origins. What can we do to protect neighborhood character and retain the attributes that make these neighborhoods unique and desirable places to be preserved? I have six suggestions that the committee still needs to explore, and close with one inquiry. First, identify the unique qualities within each neighborhood that are worth preserving, then agree on methods of their preservation. Second, I would make a generalization that maintaining open space should be a top priority in our growing city, not infill within existing neighborhoods. Open space provides multiple benefits, ranging from physical recreation, the potential for large tree canopies and urban gardens, to solar access, buffers from adjacent neighbors, wildlife habitat, view preservation, and increased air quality. Maintaining open spaces retain neighborhood character and increase property value within those neighbors. Third, zoning should be maintained as defined by the 2035 Comprehensive Plan. Modifying it to include a quarter-mile housing opportunity zone is not the solution, and neither is upzoning of R5 and R10 zones to R2.5. Fourth, new development should respect the existing architectural style, context, materials, and scale of the housing in that existing neighborhood. Height limitations need to be in scale with adjacent properties. Existing housing that is in good condition should be required to remain in place. Can I have 30 seconds? Fifth, comments from the majority of the Portland Neighborhood Associations regarding density and maintaining neighborhood character have not been adequately addressed in the RIPSAC report. This needs to be rectified. Sixth, it should be acknowledged that RIPSAC is not unanimous in its recommendations. A subgroup, RIPSAC 7, has presented several concerns in the November 4, 2016 response to the project concept report. RIPSAC 7 comments should be reviewed by the City Council as they clearly reflect the majority of neighborhood concerns. In closing, please consider this inquiry in regards to the proposed high-density developments as depicted by the Housing Opportunity Overlay Zone. I wonder if in the year 2056, you will hear a reflection like this. My father said this neighborhood used to have beautiful front yards that looked like little botanical gardens, giant evergreens that would sway in the wind, birds that would hover just outside your window, and children could be seen running from yard to yard. I wonder when all that changed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you both. Okay, let's take some more.
Guy Bryant. Annie Ray Shepherd Shapiro, Terrence Jablinski Milton, Jim Brown, Robert Liberty. Oh, we have another.
Good evening, welcome.
Liberty, you'll be next.
Ready? Go ahead.
Okay, Terry Dublinski-Milton, you know who I am. Most of my opinions here, unless cited, are mine. I'd like to voice my support of RIPSAC. We have a housing crisis, and a lot of it has been constrained because of the vast expanse of their single-family zones. But I specifically would like to point to an August submission from the North Tabor neighborhood that was called an R1.5 overlay. I have a handout. Basically, what we're arguing, or at the time, I'm not currently on the board, but was at the time, is that on an R5 property, if you seismically upgrade the older house, lift it up and put another unit underneath, and then save the tree canopy, you could have a 1.5 overlay on top of the R5 property. That way, we would be doing three things at once. We would be saving the trees, saving the old house, and adding density, at the same time creating resiliency through a seismic event. We all know that when the Cascadia zone snaps, all of this attempt to save the older houses is going to be for naught because a large number of them are going to be gone. And if we tailored this approach, this overlay approach, so that by right you could develop, if you developed in a very specific way and created this compromise, you could have up to four units on an R5 building, on an R5 lot, where it was tailored around the neighborhood context. I could, and since we're going to have open comment, I can submit a PowerPoint.
Great. Thank you very much. Please do. That's a very intriguing idea.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Mayor Hales, commissioners, thank you for having me. My name is Annie Rose Shapiro, and I'm a residential and commercial realtor with Urban Nest Realty and Workspace Commercial. My focus is on accessory dwelling units, small homes, creative financing and purchasing, and cottage clusters. And first of all, I just want to say a word about urgency. Everything changed last Tuesday. Portland has just announced that we are now a sanctuary city. But I want to know, how are we going to be able to provide actual physical sanctuary in a housing crisis? Much of our existing inner southeast neighborhoods with creative multifamily housing were built up due to a housing crisis caused by the urgency of World War II. We're in a crisis, and it's dire. I urge the council to fast-track any means that get us to greater affordability and density. We might have lives depending on this. We need to have a place for the people who need sanctuary here. So increasing the number of allowed ADUs seems one much agreed upon bit of low-hanging fruit. That's something that I've observed today. As a realtor, I'd like to contribute a few things. There's a huge demand for smaller-sized homes. Millennials, especially my customers, my age group, they want small homes that are well-designed, energy-efficient, and close to amenities and transit. They walk into a 1,500-square-foot house, and they go, oh, my God, it's too much. No, I can't maintain this. Under 400K, it's selling like hotcakes. Properties with additional income-producing units on-site increase the affordability at purchase because mortgage companies allow a first-time home buyer to include rental income as part of their gross income. And this also provides a potential to support our growing community of small developers. These are local people who live here, put the money back into their community, and make development decisions based on the needs of their community. We need to do a lot more as a city, as nonprofits, financial institutions, to support the work of these small developers, give them access to the tools they need to do these projects, and work on financing opportunities because many of them cannot access that. And we also need to focus this on communities, our oppressed communities, our threatened communities, those communities that have been excluded from much of the equity and wealth building in Portland.
Thank you very much.
Very helpful.
Thank you.
You answered a question I was wanting to be answered, is whether mortgage companies would lend based on the rental, and they do.
I had a client on disability, and he qualified for $185,000. We could not find him anything that he could live in. He could not afford to or physically do repairs. He just bought a duplex for $270,000 that's in perfect, wonderful condition, and he'll be able to have rental income and support for the rest of his life.
Perfect. Thank you. That's very
helpful. Excellent. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm Jim Brown, 3407 Northeast 27th. I serve on the UNR Steering Committee. I've lived in Northeast Portland for about 70 years. I've seen a lot of change and recognize that the city must continue to evolve. That said, I believe the RIP proposal in its current form will bring about undesirable consequences in addition to accelerating demolition of good livable homes. Half-mile-wide transportation corridors do not affect my Alameda neighborhood at this time because the bus lines through the neighborhood do not run that frequently. However, as written, the proposal leaves transportation corridor definition and establishment open to TriMet's responses to increased ridership, thereby de facto up- or downzoning some areas. As density increases in proposed overlay areas, north of Alameda, ridership will increase, possibly upzoning the entire neighborhood. Other single-family residential areas would be affected in the same way, generating increased density in a haphazard way, far from centers, and ultimately rezoning all of R5 Portland. Blanket rezoning fails to take into account the proximity of proposed new multi-unit residences to businesses, services, stores, offices, and other amenities in the nearby center. Rather than setting a fixed boundary distance from a center or corridor for areas of increased residential density, the zone boundary should depend on the number of amenities offered in the nearby center. The proposed overlay is much too large. Rezoning this much single-family Portland will result in spotty densification, depending not only on proximity to centers, but also on which homes will be most profitable to replace or internally convert. Haphazard development will result in random overloading of infrastructure, such as streets and sewers. Families buy their homes for the long term. This proposal leaves too much uncertainty. I suggest a process that takes into account the concerns I have expressed here and involves property owners and renters in the planning for their areas. A neighborhood-compatible approach to increasing density will take more time and work, but will do a better job of keeping Portland, Portland. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Next, Robert Liberty, Dean Giswold, Gary Whitehall. Are they here?
Some of them were here earlier, but I don't see them now.
Hope Baraka, Sylvia Link, Jan Kuhl-Orbach, Diana Moosman. Okay, I think some of these people will be here. Richard Lushner,
yep,
Robert Bernstein, Tamara DeRitter.
Okay, you're 3 for 3 on that list. Good evening, welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Mayor Hales. I'm Bob Bernstein. Thanks for having this nighttime meeting. Thanks for being here. Couple of things, whatever you can do to save big trees, you know how I stand on big trees, or I like to look at big trees. I don't actually stand on them. But something about flag lots concerns me. I have a large lot next door, and I have nightmares about somebody putting in a flag lot, and then I would have possibly a driveway right next to my bedroom. Can you imagine what that would be like? Not a lot of fun. So if there's anything that you could do, like to make sure that there's a decent buffer, or maybe no new driveway gets put in, they have to use the driveway that's already there as the driveway back. You know, probably wouldn't have that great, in, you know, like a downside, because there probably aren't that many flag lots. I'm concerned about the speed of this. I'm concerned about the variance that this committee has taken from its guidance, which is, we'll address the scale and design of new houses and home additions, as well as determine where new houses on narrow lots would be allowed. The project will focus on single dwelling standards. There are three topics: scale of houses, narrow lot development, and range of housing types. How did it get to zoning changes? I've been on boards before. Thinking has to have some sort of discrete boundaries to it. I'm also concerned that that over one-third of the people involved on this came from developers or the architect community who have a vested interest. And I know from living for close to 71 years that you can get whatever outcome you want by how you staff a committee. You know, and it's sort of like a DA using a grand jury. You can keep your hands clean, but you get what you want out of it. So I would like to see this really slowed down a bit. Maybe try it in Cully if they're in favor of it. Try it somewhere. But don't do something that could wreck Portland neighborhoods. I'm totally in favor of ADUs. Have no problem, you know, look at all with internal, you know, like I don't remember the term for it. That's fine. But go slow. You know, this is a major undertaking. I don't like the speed. Like, this is like when I go fishing and I hit a big fish and it's 100 yards downstream from me all of a sudden. I don't like that. I sometimes feel like I should be voting for the people who head BPS rather than the five of you.
Thank you.
A little snarky, but I feel it's deserved.
Thanks. Good evening.
Hi. My name is Richard Lishner. I'm an architect and a resident of Portland. I live half a block off Division. I am against the RIPSAC proposal. I am at a loss to understand the timing, the urgency, and the extent of this proposal to upend single-family zoning in 40% of the city. I am not sure of its legality, but the sense of betrayal is palpable. The Planning Department admits that any growth in the city's population can be accommodated on the arterials and town centers without gutting residential neighborhoods. I do not understand who this is for. I have lived off Division for 24 years in a 105-year-old bungalow that was to be destroyed along with the entire neighborhood for the Mount Hood Freeway. My neighborhood was to be thrown away. Now, 30 years later, it's the hottest neighborhood in town. Development pressure, aided and abetted by deal-making, grand compromises, and entitlement, will now lead to the wholesale demolition of some of the best housing stock in Portland with nothing to show for it. I live in a teardown. As an architect whose career has been devoted to improving and maintaining quality housing, can you fully understand how depressing this is to me? My family is only the fourth family to have lived in this house. We will probably be the last. An image of the Portland bungalow was cited as the overwhelming winner of the planning department's visual survey 20 years ago. My 1,200 square foot, two-bedroom, one-bath house on a 40 by 100 lot is worth north of $400,000. My house has a new roof, an entirely new plumbing system, a new furnace, and since I'm an architect who has designed and consulted on remodels on five other houses on the street, it still needs a new bathroom, a kitchen, and a paint job. None of this is relevant, since my house will be torn down when my wife and I leave and will be worth what it is worth in spite of or despite of any improvements we make. I live in a teardown, and these proposals will only hasten its destruction. Thus, an example of the best middle housing anywhere with clearly another 100